Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Let's go there.
With Shira and Ryan.
Oh, entertainment.
Music. Pop culture.
LGBT plus news. Let's go there.
Starts now.
Hello. Hi. Happy November
Hello.
1st.
Hello.
This
Hello.
Is the day we go from Halloween to basically Christmas.
Yeah, that's what
it's
I was going to say. It's Christmas time. Ding, ding, ding,
the countdown
ding,
begins.
I wish we could play Walking Around the Christmas Tree, because honestly, I am ready this weekend. I am putting my Christmas tree up. That
you
is
are.
The first thing I'm doing this week, and I'm waking up bright and early on Saturday, and I'm putting my Christmas tree up because it deserves to be fresh and let out the closet.
Like fresh? Plastic fresh?
Okay, yeah, same. Same thing. What's the point? What's
the
difference?
I wish I had money just to buy you like a real tree just to spite you.
Guess what? I would never take it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And you're not allowed in my house, remember?
Oh, yeah, that one time. Okay. Yeah, I got it. Thanks for the reminder. So last night was Halloween, of course.
Mm-hmm.
What did you end up doing, Ryan?
Nothing.
Did you at least watch anything scary?
No, I didn't. I watched Charmed.
Okay, a little Halloween themed.
No, Charmed's not Halloween.
What is?
At
it's
all.
Like witch themed?
No, but they're like everyday witches.
Okay.
So they're very relatable in that case. So you're welcome. I did nothing. I stayed in bed. I laid out. I ordered food. And I was very happy
okay.
with that. People were hitting me up being like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Nothing.
Well, you're so popular.
I mean, yeah, basically.
Well, what I did, and thanks for asking.
We don't have that much time.
I put on a pink wig. And let me tell you, I don't usually wear wigs, and it might be my new favorite thing.
Yeah, actually, I saw you in that wig, and I meant to tell you something that I'll tell you off air.
Okay.
That was a hardcore tease. Because that was a hardcore tease, because I don't want to say what I want to say on air
that is not
about
fair.
That wig.
Because I liked wearing the wig anyway.
No, the wig was beautiful.
Wig
the wig was beautiful, kind of.
At any rate, I jumped around, bopped around as a fairy around town.
A workout fairy.
A workout fairy.
You are literally what body positivity fights against.
Actually, no, because I was embracing my body, so whatever body is a body that you want to embrace is body positivity.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You're just throwing in the face that you're a workout fairy.
It could be working out in life, like I'm just running around. My working out, you know, is just like jumping around. It's not actually working out. It's just like bopping and dancing.
Way,
I'm a dance fairy. Anyway.
I'm happy you had a wonderful 80s Halloween.
Dance fairy.
I'm happy you had a wonderful Halloween.
I did, but it got cut short. Anyway, I can celebrate Halloween every single day, and I will continue to celebrate
Well,
it.
We should be celebrating our guest in studio
yes.
today, Eugene Yet. Lee Yang.
Yes.
I always want to cut out his middle like Lee, but it's Eugene Lee Yang from Try Guys. He is literally our queer gay icon. I'm honestly obsessed with him and so happy that he was here.
Yeah, a lot of fun. We'll be playing that interview and all the highlights coming up on the show. So definitely stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's get into some what's trending in the news right now. Top of the hour. Big news coming out of the presidential race. Former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke announced today that he is ending his 2020 presidential campaign. That was hours before a big dinner he had in Iowa. He told supporters in an email that he will not run for office next year, which means he will also not become a Senate candidate in Texas, despite many pleas from some Democrats for him to take on Republican Senator John Cornyn. He said this in a statement. Though it is difficult to accept, it is clear to me now that this campaign does not have the means to move forward successfully. My services to the country will not be as a candidate or as a nominee. Acknowledging this now is in the best interest of those in the campaign. It is in the best interest of this party as we seek to unify around a nominee, and it is in the best interest of the country.
I mean, are we shocked? No, we're not. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of more people need to be following his lead because it started off strong for Beto, but then it most definitely fell off, and it kind of picked up a little bit when that shooting happened in El Paso, but I don't think it was enough to garner the support that he needed. And I don't think he was, especially I think he also lost a lot of, obviously, moderates and probably Republicans on the whole gun reform thing, where he was very extreme about the gun buyback program and all these different things. But I still feel like that is something that Democrats and our country needs to be facing into the idea of gun reform. But yeah, Beto, I didn't think he had a chance in the first place.
He probably needs a break. I mean,
that's exciting.
This loss and the other loss he had earlier this year, it's a lot.
I mean,
like, getting drained,
he's going to get a great show on MSNBC or CNN. He's going to be a great, you know, commentator,
a buck,
kind of like Andrew Gillum, who's a commentator on CNN now. And yeah, I think that's really all that matters. He's still going to have a platform, so that's all he really needs.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to another Democratic presidential candidate, Senator Amy Klobuchar. I can't believe she's still in the race. Well, in 2008, it has come out that she requested $500,000 in taxpayer money to go towards an anti-drug program run by Minnesota Teen Challenge. Now, that's a group with anti-LGBTQ views that is also associated with the world's largest Pentecostal group, the Assemblies of God. And the Pentecostal denomination is fundamentalist and very anti-LGBTQ. So
I grew up Pentecostal.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
This Church of God in Christ.
Okay. Well, it's unclear if the Minnesota Teen Challenge ever received the money. It was meant to fund this Know the Truth program for what they're saying is drug prevention education efforts for teens. But the group is also, I would say this makes sense because the group is also called Halloween, Harry Potter, Pokemon, Gateways to Drug Addiction, listed homosexuality as a problem similar to drug addiction, too. What do you think about all that, Ryan?
Having grown up in, like I said, being Pentecostal, this is something that you do go through, you do hear, especially me being a young queer black boy in the South. I heard often over the pulpit them talking about homosexuals and how it was terrible and all these things and burn in hell. Like, you hear that narrative, and it's unfortunately, it's very scary kind of being a part of that and still kind of still having a love relation, like still having a love for the church and having that moment. Amy Klobuchar, I think, is a mess.
Well, yeah, I mean, do you think this is going to put her back? Because it seems like now...
Well, my thing is, yeah, because she actually, you know, in the LGBTQ forum that was a town hall that was not too long ago on CNN, she actually bragged about being part of the first church that was accepting of all people, LGBTQ people. And so this is interesting that this is coming out, because that's something that she did not mention. And I think anytime you are, especially at the rate that you are as Amy Klobuchar, which is basically not even seen, it can be a hit to your campaign.
Oh, yeah. So Klobuchar would definitely be in the spotlight in terms of how she's looking at the LGBTQ community and her pastor on that. So we'll keep you up to date on anything more that comes up around Amy Klobuchar, because it seems like there's not good stuff. And maybe she'll be the next one out of the race. Who knows? But coming up, after many attacks from all sides, Elizabeth Warren has finally released her plan for Medicare for All if elected president in 2020. We'll be bringing you all the details coming up next.
Let's Go There with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
After much anticipation, Elizabeth Warren finally came out with her plan for Medicare for All. It's a 20-page report, and
which we all knew was going to happen. Mm-hmm. The night of that debate, when everyone was kind of pressuring her, the only thing it showed that she was a top candidate.
Yeah.
And also, everyone knows Elizabeth is known for her plan, but something like this, Medicare for All, is such a huge deal, because it shapes and changes like what we know when it comes to insurance and policies and doctors and everyone involved. And so this is not just something that could just be just thrown out into air. This has had to be well thought out, especially because this is a big thing that she is fighting for, and it could impact how positively the rest of her campaign goes.
Yeah, she got industry experts to be part of this. This isn't just from her brain. Like, she took some time, and you could see it, and we're going to get into details. In the tweets where she talked a bit about it high level, she said, "My plan won't raise taxes one penny on middle-class families. In fact, we'll return about $11 trillion to the American people. That's bigger than the biggest tax cut in our history." So here to help us get into this and just understand it all, Yasmin Abutaleb, health policy reporter at Washington Post. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so once again, it was this 20-page plan. It's pretty detailed. A lot of people wanted to see it. Finally, it's here. So what are the big takeaways?
So Elizabeth Warren, in the presidential debate on this, she was a bit vague on whether this would raise middle-class taxes. Bernie Sanders, of course, has been pretty straightforward that, yes, it would raise taxes on the middle class, but they would, their overall costs would be lowered. So this plan actually did not raise taxes on the middle class. It touted that as this rolled out, saying it's not going to raise taxes on the middle class one penny. Instead, it expands her wealth tax proposal, which has become a sort of signature proposal of her campaign. Employers would still have to pay a pretty significant chunk into the healthcare system.
Right.
Instead of paying for their employees' healthcare, it would be put into a sort of public Medicare for all system. So the $9 trillion they were projected to spend over the next decade would go into her Medicare for all plan. So it basically would greatly increase taxes on the wealthy and on corporations. And in the way she's crafted this, it would spare middle class and lower income Americans from higher taxes.
Which is so interesting, this because this is obviously a lot of different other countries actually have systems in place like this. But I do wonder, and a lot of people are actually bringing up that, you know, this could also affect doctors and people in hospitals and hospitals in general. I was wondering, how does that really work out? Because I guess the question that comes into play is, like, what to pay hospitals and doctors, because Medicare pays doctors and hospitals much less than private insurance. And this would basically kind of just get rid of private insurance.
Right. So there's a reason that most of the healthcare industry is opposed to Medicare for all and giving the government this much power in setting prices. Right now, you know, when you go into a hospital, you don't necessarily know what you're going to end up paying between your insurance and out of pocket. Hospitals typically charge much more to people with private insurance. Medicare rates to hospitals are much lower, and to doctors are lower than private insurance. So when it comes to the healthcare industry, most sectors are pretty opposed to this, because it would mean that their profits and their margins would fall, because they would be paid more in line with Medicare rates.
Yeah, I mean, we need a total shift to the system. So is this something that is possible? And I mean, there's going to be so many people that are going to fare well, and then a lot of people that are going to lose. Is it possible to make everyone happy here?
No, it's definitely not. If you want to see people pay less and you want the government to pay less, you know, right now the U.S. pays the most per patient of any country. That means someone is going to lose. It means the companies are going to lose. It means they're going to see less money. A lot of people would probably welcome lower costs, and this her plan has no deductibles, no out-of-pocket costs, which would be a huge shift from the way our system is structured now.
Yeah.
But any plan to overhaul the healthcare system, even incremental changes to the healthcare system, are extremely hard to accomplish politically. These are well-funded industries with lots of lobbyists. They have a lot to lose if these changes come into place. There's a reason the system is set up the way it is. A lot of the companies are actually doing quite well under this type of system.
Of course.
Which, you know, that's the thing. And I feel like Elizabeth Warren is all about, you know, kind of taking down the rich in some way and having them pay more and really being there for middle-class Americans. But I do wonder, what are some of the political ramifications of this? Because it is a very difficult and very confusing thing, when, especially this entire process where you're shifting an entire industry. And it could be something that could be very hardcore for a lot of people to understand and also to be a part of.
Right. I mean, I think as things stand, this would be a pretty politically impossible feat to accomplish, even if you had unified Democratic control of the White House and both chambers of Congress. This just likely wouldn't happen. You're talking about increasing taxes a huge amount on wealthy corporations that would fight back hard against this. And, you know, politically, I think even more than the math, politically, this is going to be very difficult. And taking on the health industry in this type of way, especially some kind of massive overhaul. I mean, we saw with the Affordable Care Act how difficult it was to pass that. And that passed because eventually the Obama administration and Congress worked to sort of get every sector of the healthcare industry on board. And that's a much smaller shift than what we're talking about when it comes to Medicare for all.
So I guess where do we land? Because I feel like this, it was detailed, it makes sense, but there's going to be the rich that don't want to see this happen and all the companies that are already profiting. So like, those are the loopholes, basically. I mean, what are the loopholes for the other Democratic candidates? What are they going to drag her over?
well, they're going to say that this isn't feasible, that you're going to hurt innovation this way, that you're going to hurt doctors. Political candidates generally don't like taking on their local hospital, especially people like their local hospital. They have emotional attachment to it. Hospitals and doctors are opposed to this. They're going to say it's going to lower their payments. It's going to lower the quality of care. So those are all things that opponents to this can say. And they're going to say, you know, a lot, they'll continue pointing to polls saying the majority of Americans like their private insurance. They like their employer provided insurance. So why are we going to eliminate choice for people? You know, one point of pride for a lot of politicians and for people in the U.S. system is there's more choice than there is in a country that has a more socialized or more government-controlled form of health insurance.
All right. Will this help her, like put her in the lead at least, or put her ahead of some of the other players since she finally presented a plan?
I think we have to sort of wait and see how that bears out. The details could end up hurting her. You know, and there is this sort of question now around electability, which comes up over and over. Is this too progressive? You know, she is in the lead right now. She's the only candidate who's sort of consistently climbing in the polls. But there are, of course, already questions of, is this too progressive? Is this not going to be palatable to general election voters? Maybe it's okay for Democratic primary voters who will encourage taking on corporations in the way she sort of centered a lot of her campaign. But there will be questions about, you know, as we head into a general election, what are people going to say about this? And are people going to be supportive of a sort of massive overhaul of the U.S. healthcare system?
Yes.
I mean, even right with the ACA, you saw how upset people were to lose some of the insurance that they had.
I am interested in the comparisons that, you know, with Bernie and her being so close, especially on, you know, thought process about this entire plan. I am interested in how people respond versus to his plan versus hers and what that really looks like in the deeper conversation when it comes to where we're at currently politically. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Yasmin Aboutaleb, again, is a health policy reporter at Washington Post. Now we are moving into top stories in pop culture and entertainment news with the T, Ryan.
Yes, so coming up in 6 minutes, Bella Thorne is being accused of glamorizing domestic abuse. Find out why, because, honey, I am spilling the tea coming up next.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
Honey, Halloween was last night.
Yeah.
And obviously the celebrities were all out and putting out their best work, except for Bella Thorne, because she actually shared a very eyebrow-raising makeup look for Halloween that has pissed some people off. Basically, you know, I'm actually really tired of talking about Bella Thorne. I feel like she's always doing some stuff that is like either for her a cry out for attention or like something where she's like crying over something Whoopi Goldberg has said, and I'm like so over her if you really want to think about it, but
she gives us content.
She does give us content, producer Vanessa said. And we, I'm friends with her stylist, so I kind of always support her through that way. But basically, she posted a trio of selfies to Instagram showing a bruised jawline, swollen and bruised eyes, and a cut on her lip, prompting many to think the former Disney star had been assaulted, only to realize it was just makeup. I mean, the caption said this, hire me for your Halloween makeup, I got you, boo. So, you know, basically she did let everyone know, but people don't read. People just see the photos.
I was one of those people. I saw that photo, and at first I was like, oh my God, is she revealing like something happened? Like, was she beaten up?
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, that's makeup. The makeup was too real. See, it was like, what is it? Was it a scene in a movie? It's like Halloween makeup should be fake looking. That's
no,
the point.
I mean, but
like, or just over the top.
But
it
that's
shouldn't
also
look
the thing
so
where,
real. Like, it looked real. Like,
but that's also the thing where people love the fake makeup and they love how realistic it looks. I mean, those are the ones that get the most attention. And so.
But there's a difference between like a horror character and being like, you know, a character type thing. And like what she did,
well, she
it was
really
also subtle. It looked like she was, someone beat her up.
Well, she really didn't show what her entire costume was. I think
exactly. She,
after posting that, she was done. So you never know what character she could have been. But either way, a number of people have slammed the images accusing the star of glamorizing being physically assaulted. Someone said, why is glamorizing being physically abused culturally appropriate during Halloween? Another one said, I'm not the only one who thinks this thinks this is insensitive. I don't understand the point of this. Is she trying to be a battered woman? One even said that the star may have just been showing off her makeup skills, but agreed, agreed that the photo was very triggering. So I don't know.
I think
it was also like I don't follow her, but when I like saw the story and I looked at the photo, I was like, oh, that does look pretty real. And I mean, kudos for you for the makeup skills, but also. Yeah, you got to be careful. You're a public figure. You also have been one that has, talked about kind of you being, assaulted sexually before.
Exactly.
Like people kind of not expect this, but they are expecting you to be open in that way. They're not shocked when you're telling a story or they see photos or you crying. Like, that's not something that is shocking to them. So when you're just doing this and you're not really warning people in the way that you probably should, yeah, of course you're going to get these reactions.
Also, if it was a picture someone took of her, it would have been different. It was a selfie. It felt like a very raw moment that she documented of after having gone through something traumatic.
Just how her face looks.
No, it's not.
First of all, she does have that face where she looks like she's always going to cry. Not going to lie to you.
Oh, okay.
She does. She has that face where you feel bad for her.
She's dramatic.
She's a little dramatic. Well, either way, we got more to talk about in What's the Tea. Because, okay, we got to talk about Charlie XCX. Because some fans of hers have been getting her to sign some very uncomfortable items during a meet and greet. Find out what Charlie thinks of it after people feel like she is being taken advantage of. I don't know. We're going to dive in coming up next.
Let's go there. With Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
We are back with What's the Tea, our entertainment pop culture stories of the day. And Charlie XCX is in the headlines because she is, shutting down claims that fans are taking advantage of her by making her sign some very controversial items during meet and greets. So,
not like a boob or butt.
No, let's break this down.
Okay.
So basically, Twitter users and press and are calling out fans for making her, write her name on some very wacky items. Her fan base is very gay in multiple ways. Mm-hmm. And so here's some of the list of the items. Someone had her sign a bottle of poppers. Had her sign an enema.
Somebody to put up your butt?
Yeah. And also someone else had her sign the ashes of a fan's dead mom.
Wow.
Yeah, but I guess basically Charlie is saying, because a lot of people were like, whoa, this is weird. Why are you having her sign these things? And it seems like you guys are only doing this for kind of like online clout and you want... you want to have the tweet that goes and gets viral, those moments where you have her picture and you have her sign something like, you're a fan of a dead mom, like the ashes of a dead mom or something. It's very weird. Well, she's actually saying that all that scrutiny is very misguided. She says, the articles that have been popping up about my meet and greet suggesting that fans are taking advantage of being abusive or using me for online clout because of uncertain items that have been brought along to meet and greets are just so ridiculous and pretentious. She said that the press is feeding into this fake wokeness mentality and stirring up controversy to create clickbait. Mm. She says, it's all wrapped up in this brand of 2019 fake wokeness that I cannot stand. It does more harm than good and just encourages people to attack and harness one another online.
Honestly, how about it just being like fun? Now that people know, fans know that she'll sign those things, it becomes something fun to do.
Well, I will say, it is a little weird and kind of gross that you're bringing in something. And maybe even
it's
if
very
it was
personal,
new,
that
yeah.
goes into parts of your body.
Yeah,
okay,
like I feel like that's a little weird, and
totally.
I get it. And I saw the actual photo that people were causing a question, and the guy that actually bought that item, and I was like, okay, this is weird, but also kind of funny. But it's just you don't really know what's going through her head in that moment, because obviously people have paid for those meet and greets. They have waited outside, in the cold and all these things, which she actually explained and offended those people that go to her meet and greets as sweet. She says, I take away the fact that people wait outside in the cold for me, tell me that a certain song changed their life or that a particular album got them through a tough time. Mm-hmm. She said, these things are the things I dwell. I don't think about the pictures or the objects
exactly.
I sign. She also asked her fans, as well as the press, just ask for her opinion instead of painting her as some kind of helpless damsel, and that she hopes that she can continue to provide a safe space for freedom of expression.
Exactly. Get over yourselves.
I mean, meet and greets are expensive. I would honestly, the only meet and greet that I've ever paid for was one for Paramore, and I got to meet Haley Williams. Yeah, she was amazing.
Very cool. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. If you're paying that, you get to bring anything for them to sign.
Kind of low key, but yeah, if you want to know more about this story and any of our other pop culture entertainment stories, head over to WeAreChannelQ.com. Make sure to keep us favorited on that radio.com app.
Now, coming up, the story of a wife who sued her husband for coming out as gay. That's next on What's Trending in the News in 11 minutes.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
So we are getting into what's trending in the news right now, top of the hour. Let's talk about this story. A wife who found out her husband was gay and then she is suing him.
Wow, petty.
I mean, yeah. So this woman is unnamed. From Cape Town. She is demanding money.
Oh, that explains. Okay. All right. Yeah. Continue.
Just under $600,000 due to what she's saying is the emotional pain and psychological trauma, which led to a loss of income after unwittingly becoming her husband's beard. That's what she's saying. Right. The husband waited until 2 months before their sixth anniversary to come out to her. Since which time they have no longer lived together as man and wife. That's from the judge. He explained that in a statement. The basis for the damages claim and the extraordinary sums which are sought is that the husband is alleged to have misrepresented to her prior to their marriage that he was a heterosexual male who wished to marry her so that they could have children in a heterosexual monogamous marriage.
Did they have kids? They didn't have kids, did they?
I don't know. It says, well, they got married to have kids, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know they probably, obviously they got married.
According to the judge, the wife's affidavit was largely devoted to narrating in the finest and most intimate detail how the husband came to reveal that he was homosexual, going on to set out in further explicit detail the contents of highly private and personal communications. He also called the wife out for snooping in her husband's private internet browsing activity. Wow, this is
drama. So wait, was he cheating or was he just looking at porn?
Well, we'll continue. Publication of this material could be said to constitute an unjustified breach of the husband's right to privacy, if not that of the wife herself. So not only did he dismiss the case, he ordered the woman's lawyer to forfeit his fee and pay the husband's legal fees. Because imagine, like, you're talking about the trauma you're bringing on to someone else, right? Like, not only do you go through a divorce, which is traumatic enough, being sued for living your truth and revealing that to your partner.
Is divorce? I guess, yeah, divorce
is
traumatic.
It can be traumatic, yeah. The judge claimed that her suit included everything but the proverbial kitchen sink, a lot of accusations in hopes that something would stick, an irregular step and an abusive process. That's what the judge said. So anyway, that in this case, the court did the right thing. But can you believe?
I mean, it's
believe?
Petty. That is so petty that she even thought that was she could win a case like that. My thing is, it's interesting because it's not saying that her feelings aren't valid maybe she did feel, you know, tricked in some way. But I think she has to understand, and that comes from even being a different culture, and also the lawyer that got that number and tried to calculate all that number together. Her lawyer, they clearly don't know that experience, and maybe they can get to a place, her and her now ex-husband, to talk about kind of like what he was going through and why he couldn't accept himself. Because I think there just needs to be openness, and obviously she feels, you know, lied to, and she needs to feel like, where were you coming from? And maybe they'll get to a place one day where they hear each other and they respect each other.
Or like, you use me, how dare you? I mean, I had a friend that actually got married, and they weren't married for that long, but they'd been together for like maybe 5 to 10 years, like a long-term relationship. And after they got married, they were together for a few years. He came out as gay.
But here's the thing. That doesn't take away the fact that did have feelings for her.
Totally.
Like, even this man, he probably most definitely had feelings for her. But it's just very conflicting when you're trying to figure out who you are, because you're doing it for so many reasons. And it's not to say that those feelings were not valid and real.
Listen, things change. I give people a lot of credit for being in that situation, being able to live their truth.
It's just a narrative of being, like, down low that is, like, there's so much more to that.
Mm-hmm.
And also in how society makes men not feel comfortable enough to one, explore their sexuality or even talk about their sexuality. And so that's why, you know, things like this happen.
Yeah. Let's move on to Senators Kamala Harris and Richard Blumenthal. They're demanding an investigation into the death of Roxana Hernandez, an asylum seeker who died in ICE custody due to a lack of medical care. This happened on May 25th. She passed away while still in custody, and the autopsy requested by her family found that the cause of death was likely dehydration combined with complications from HIV, and that she may have been beaten before she died. Now, Harris and Blumenthal, they want an explanation. They sent a letter to Attorney General William Barr requesting more information, and they said there remain significant factual disputes relating to the circumstances surrounding Ms. Hernandez's death. Her surviving family, the United States Congress, and the American people deserve answers. An investigation into her death has been, it has been stopped, though, or I guess like a bit delayed by the deletion of evidence by ICE contractor CoreCivic. And we actually talked about this story, I think maybe last week. One of the country's largest private prison companies, though they had required to retain video footage relating to potential lawsuits, they don't have any of the video footage of Hernandez in the facilities. It was wiped within 90 days. So this is going to be a bit of an uphill battle. But that was what's trending in the news right now, top of the hour. In the next hour, we'll be bringing you more, including the latest from actress Lori Loughlin and the college scam. Mm-hmm. And whether she is going to plead guilty or if she still remains innocent. But more importantly, we've got something huge coming up.
Finally, I've been waiting for this because it was a great, great conversation. Mm-hmm. And you really need to listen to all the gems that Eugene Lee Yang from Try Guys just dropped our way.
Oh, yeah. He's coming up right after this. So stay tuned.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
We are back, and we are so excited to have our next guest in studio, in the flesh with us. You know him from the Try Guys and so much more. Eugene Lee Yang, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I mean, honestly, you dressed up really well for us. I appreciate it. I don't think we deserved it. He's in a full-on suit and turtleneck, Mom.
Well, I told you, yesterday was Halloween.
Yeah.
And I had full-on old-age prosthetics that are very hard to rip off. So when I ripped them off, I had a little not-so-cute pattern.
Did it look like just several hickeys?
It looked like 20 hickeys.
Oh, that's a good night.
Which, I'm a grown man now. That was like my 20s. That was Halloween.
I mean, first of all, you can still do hickeys just in places that don't need to be seen. Come on.
Okay, Ryan.
Period.
We go there.
I know what to do.
Yeah, we don't censor ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I threw on the turtleneck to be a little more appropriate.
Yeah.
And professional.
I don't know why I thought to throw the suit on over it, but I just felt...
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It looks good.
I wanted to dress up for y'all.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. You have come so far. I feel like you've had cat lives, right?
I have often been told I act like a cat.
Is that your...
Well, because I'm such a dog person.
Oh, I'm a dog person, too.
I'm a huge animal person in general.
Yeah, yeah.
But clearly, I'm a dog person. People don't know. It's because I'm allergic to cats.
Me, too.
But I love cats' attitudes.
I'm allergic to cats' attitudes.
Yeah, well, I know. I like their attitudes. Mm-mm. They look like they can treat themselves. They know what they're doing.
I come from a black mother. If you have an attitude... Pat. I don't play no games.
So yeah, I think the one thing I've realized is that I behave more like a cat.
Okay.
But I love the unadulterated, unconditional love of dogs.
Yeah.
Because I'm such a dark person in general.
That
I just need the easy access to affection from an animal when I need it. So I don't need to earn it like a cat.
That's amazing.
So I get home and I'm tired and I'm in my head and then the dog's just there depending on me.
Yeah.
But without the whole business that involves childbirth and children.
I wonder, like, I guess, because I was sitting here thinking about this. I wonder, how would you describe yourself, especially now that you've come out in a very public way, which we're going to get to. But I guess, how would you describe who Eugene is if people didn't know who you were?
Goodness. I think I'm pretty complex. I feel like I'm layered, as Shrek would say, like an onion. Or as Donkey would say, a parfait. Is that a weird reference
pull
out of my...
No, yeah, Halloween.
It makes it accessible.
Yeah, no, I've always
Everyone
felt like I have somewhat of a complex history to me, and also the presentation of being someone who is widely seen on the digital platforms, mm-hmm. particularly coming from a place like BuzzFeed where I used to work.
Uh-huh.
There certainly is a lot of leading with love and light and positivity, that wasn't necessarily inherent to me as a person. It wasn't something that was something that I tapped into as an artist in particular. So if you see my coming out video, the tone of it is quite dark. And that is really the core of how I've always sort of expressed myself as a person. So places like YouTube have helped me become more, how to put it, accessible and mainstream, I guess.
That's but so interesting.
It certainly was not anywhere within the toolbox I was working with, coming from my closeted experience as an Asian American in Texas.
I was about to say, why do you think that was? Like, let's go a bit back to, that's why I said there's a bit of Cat Lives, it feels, where there's, we've come to know you in so many different ways.
Yes. I'm ready to reach my next form, as they say, my next evolution.
Yeah.
I think I'm somewhere in the, you know, I'm like in the Charmander, getting Charmeleon.
I was hoping this was going towards a Pokemon reference.
I just feel like I'm still in the young phases. I don't think I've even hit, like, really even the second evolution yet. I'm not my final form. That's gonna hit, I think, when I'm like 60. But I certainly feel like I'm graduating into the next form very soon.
Okay.
With this statement about being 1,000% myself with no conditions.
Yes. But then you grew up, that wasn't the case, obviously, growing up in Texas, you said, Asian American, closeted.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
How do you work through that?
It's interesting. I think that a lot of what I initially approached my work with as a filmmaker, because I was a USC film student, I was focusing primarily on writing and directing and choreographing prior to doing digital content. I approached it with a lot of anger, and I approached it with a lot of resentment and using my voice by being different. I thought that that was the way in which I could express my rage and my personal issues.
Yeah.
And so that kind of became a lot of the ways in which I viewed the world and also approached my art. And when I did that, it did successfully come across to professors I had and then the industry before I went into digital as being edgy and different. Mm, but certainly I was selling myself as an edgy othered person.
Which is most queer people, if you really think about it.
And I think we all go through, I think every queer person has to go through that phase, particularly as someone who is in a business of self-expression,
right,
that you have to, I think, go through that and then realize who your audience is and who you're speaking for. Because that it came to my attention that perhaps that position of making myself an edgy person was not for queer people, it was for a more mainstream group who wanted to see me be edgy. They liked that I was different and sort of expressing myself with this. You know, I found myself seeing my work as like a painting in the weird modern art section of museum where old white straight men could walk by and say, ooh, this is sellable and different. But it certainly wasn't
who you were.
Yeah, or catering to, I mean, it was me, but it wasn't catering to where I think I could have actually made the most impact. So then switching over, well, I guess this would be my Charmeleon phase. So that was like my Charmander. And then when I was Charmeleon, I switched over into digital just on a whim because I needed a job. And when I essentially learned how to speak the language of the internet and become more mainstream and then access parts of myself that were previously thought to be totally unrelatable and all the authenticity that we throw out that word a lot for me was from dark places. When I realized that people could connect to that, especially through humor, I found that, okay, there's power in reaching tons of people, even if I don't necessarily agree with all their opinions or if I don't know who they are. So I went on the other side where I suddenly became like a poster child for a palatable Asian American, generically potentially queer person.
So
that was like my Charmeleon phase. Yeah. And then I just had to kick that all in the ass and can I say that?
Yeah, you can say ass.
Kick that up. Thank you. Good.
In the booty.
Kick it all in the booty and combine those two elements. And that's where I'm at now, where I've realized that there's power in both approaches, the best is mixing the two and realizing that the most important thing is just speaking truthfully from your place and creating things without conditions without censoring yourself or drawing lines around your identity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're talking with the Try Guys, Eugene Lee Yang. He's a producer, director, actor, writer, and we're deep diving into kind of how you've gotten to the place and evolved into who you are now. And I think it's very interesting, the idea that you kind of had to shape yourself for, you know, cis hetero people to kind of take you in. And that's often a lot of the stories when you are a queer person of color working in this industry. Did that ever give a moment where you, when you did switch to digital? Because I feel like a lot of like filmmakers and writers and things like that I know, they're like, I have to stick to that path. And going into digital kind of seems like, at one point it did, seems like, oh, am I kind of like just settling in some way? Did you ever feel that in any way, form, shape, before you even knew what it could be?
Certainly, because I entered in 2013, the digital space, and then it was also a place where we didn't quite know how that would merge with traditional.
Yeah.
Now it's different because everyone is like Will Smith on YouTube.
Right,
you know,
right,
like
right.
It's a whole different
playground. If anything, the digital
now.
People are getting kicked out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Go
but
somewhere else.
When I got there in 2013, I did feel like I was potentially sacrificing a certain amount of creative autonomy, and I thought that I was maybe giving up on a dream. But when I look back now, I was very staunchly on this road of seeing how I could break into traditional Hollywood, which put me in a lot of diversity film programs, which are fantastic. But again, most of the things that I was applying for and most of the ways in which I was getting noticed was through diversity driven programming, which in the end, digital is the opposite, where, I mean, you looked at the landscape of BuzzFeed's top creators when we were there at its heyday, it was all queer people and people of color.
Right.
We just rose to the top naturally because I think that's what the audience wanted to see.
Oh, of course. Awesome.
And it wasn't ever under initiative of let's put all the people of color or
no.
the queer people in front.
Yeah.
It's just what the audience was reacting to most naturally. And that's what was timely for that period between like 2014 to 18 when a lot of stuff went down on the internet and we became very polarized, and certainly where I used to work was a big part of that culture shift. But I think that I never take for granted the platform that I've essentially grown accustomed to, which is having millions of people immediately see the work I do. And certainly there has been so many great lessons, especially with the Try Guys, where it's me and three cis hetero white guys, that the access that they immediately gain as guys who are, I would say, quite quite watchable for your grandma in Alabama and your edgy cousin in New York City, like everyone can watch them. I sort of molded myself after that as well, thinking, how can I access that space? And it wasn't as hard as I thought. I really did come from a background of thinking like I'm the dark, different one.
But did you ever feel
angry,
misunderstood in that in ways?
I think sometimes I did. I certainly initially, if you watch back some of the first appearances I had in digital videos, I was much more serious because I had this feeling that if I was to present myself, particularly in a cast of said cis hetero white men, I had to beat them. I had to be better.
Right.
I had to be excellent.
But that's also what queer people are taught. Well, people of color are taught.
So it's a life thing that sort of trickled into the videos.
Yeah.
And while, because I felt the weight of viewers who identified with me to show that I wouldn't be the supporting guy. I wouldn't be the comic relief. I would be the strong leading man in the group. Luckily, they're three of my best friends.
Yeah, were you always friends though? Like, how did that group even come together?
It came together when we decided to start doing these videos where we essentially wanted to get out of our comfort zones, which is like the core ideology of the Try Guys. But then also that first came across with tries that are just the purest, most relatable form of the other side, which is sort of gender exploration and this idea of gender conformity. And we literally only put on Victoria's Secret underwear in the first video. And the four of us were the only guys in the office who would do it.
No way, really? And that's how it got started?
Because we asked around, we're like, does anyone else want to do it? And so the four of us were the only ones who were willing to go on camera and do it. And then shortly thereafter, the third video did was recreating Kim Kardashian's butt photo on Paper Magazine.
Yeah, which the iconic champagne one.
Yeah, and that we were talking about, you know, the male gaze and like, you know, women in media.
Uh-huh.
And for us also at that point, we decided to put our naked butts online because the commentary wouldn't make any sense if we censored ourselves.
Yeah, and I just want to know, like, then trying out these things, do you think it would be harder to try these things out now because of, like, people, being called out and dragged in cancel culture? Like, what is the fine line between, like, where it's cool and funny and you're trying it and then it could be problematic?
I think the videos that we produced, because that was 2014,
yeah,
those made sense at the time,
because
I think the conversation was there. I certainly think most of the videos that the larger companies were putting out at that, like the BuzzFeeds and, you know, the reversal videos, they wouldn't speak as interestingly now because we have people of those backgrounds who have the voices, so we don't need to see the role reversal. But when at the time when it was interesting to see people like just very plainly and comedically look the other side, it worked. People shared that a lot. And the best example was our Motherhood series, which was it had 100 million views on Facebook and within a week. And that's when we did the pregnancy bellies and the labor simulation.
Ugh.
But truly,
oh, I remember that video.
I love watching
wild.
Men go through that.
Yeah, but truly, like, I think that was more indicative of the time where I think the culture of the viral space was about sort of the most broad stroke of exploring other people's cultures.
Or challenges and trying things out, reacting.
Yeah, now I think there's way more authority with which people who are rising online should speak with and own that. And we, as the Try Guys, don't touch that much anymore from that angle.
Which is interesting because when you did officially kind of come out, and even kind of while you were the success of the Try Guys, and you're like, all right, I am, and I'm thinking you know who you are at this point, but you're just not publicly speaking about it. Was there any pressure to say, oh, I do need to somewhat be that visibility, but also I'm kind of dealing with my own journey of not being comfortable to come out at this point?
Yeah, I think what it came down to was kids were coming up to me telling me that my presence online has helped them come out.
Mm.
So once you have children come up to you and say that, and it was happening progressively more and more throughout the years, I felt that as a 33-year-old man who is 100% comfortable in his own sexuality and is out to anyone who's in his social circles and is safe, I'm in a safe space, and I don't rely on my parents anymore. There was no reason to hide it from certain parts of my family. And there was more of the things that could be benefited from sharing my true self 1,000% to the whole world, and those kids who could benefit from that story without me withholding it, outweighed the fears I had about my family. And that's kind of when that weight shift happened, the scales shifted, I said, okay, well, there's no reason for me to be, you know, I've compared it to this idea of you're at a dinner table and you're queer and there are certain people there that you don't speak about it around, you know?
Oh, yeah, I totally relate to that. I mean, I'm also from the South, Nashville. Yeah. And so I get that kind of like you're like your mother telling you don't tell your grandmother because she can't handle it.
Exactly.
Or your other parts of your family just be kind of just you. It's like you're keeping this secret.
Yeah, and I've realized I was doing that with the audience. Mm. Like they were at my table and I realized at that point in my own dinner tables, I was ready to also just tell them like the entirety of my truth.
Or you're ready to host the dinner. You're like, this is my dinner.
I mean, and that video was some of my family members' first time even seeing anything about me being gay.
Yeah, let's talk about this video. It was posted in June 2019.
Yes, in
That's
June this year.
Recent. It was around It was around Pride. It was Pride.
And
it was Pride.
You raised over $100,000 for the Trevor Project, which is amazing. It has, what, 14 million views? No.
About 14 to 15 million.
What? Okay, so can you talk about how you orchestrated all of this? Because it was amazing.
Yeah, he wrote it, he directed it, he choreographed it, which who knew you could dance like that? It was incredible.
Oh, thanks. I taught myself really actually how to dance as a kid.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't have access to a lot of it. And also, my parents weren't going to put me in dance classes.
Yeah, I get that.
Because of gender norms, but I was certainly a big theater choir kid and I had no film in my area, so I was allowed to choreograph the musicals in high school.
Oh,
so that's where I got sort of my feet wet in that world. So it was the closest for me to get to filmmaking. But I took a few like college courses to get like the basic terminology down. So now I know what a pirouette is. But I certainly always directed from the eye of a director for film.
Yeah.
So and prior to my work at BuzzFeed, I was a music video director and I did a lot of short films.
So you knew how to do this.
Yeah.
But because so many people do, you know, it's an individual thing for you, but each person, it seems on YouTube, like they do it a certain way. It seems, you know, they're like to the camera, it's real, it's raw, confessional. Why do it in this way? And let's talk about like, the process of putting it all together.
I think that if you take it to the purest form, which is say a YouTuber vlogging and speaking their truth to camera, that's the most seamless way in which one can communicate their message. And it's the truest way. For me, it's interesting that we talk about the filmmaking style of the video, which is a little more say elevated than traditional things on even our channel, mm-hmm. as the Try
for sure.
Guys.
Yeah.
That's the mode in which I speak the most freely. And it was also something that I typically have reserved away from the viral audience, because part of me sort of selfishly as an artist, and also with this old hackneyed idea that digital and traditional still haven't merged, which they have, I thought I was going to be saving my filmmaking voice for when I broke away from digital. And there was this moment where I realized when I was presenting this video that I had to infuse this with the strongest language I knew how to speak, which was the filmmaking medium in which I'm most comfortable in.
Yeah.
And so that sort of lyricism in the cinematography and the choreography and the way in which I sort of dealt with the coming out process and journey for queer people through a higher concept,
mm-hmm.
That's the sort of core of the work I've done like outside of digital for most of my life. So to bring that forward, that was kind of my own way of speaking to camera in a vlog, because I certainly don't think I would have been as great just telling people to camera. It's not the language I'm most well versed in.
Yeah.
So I kind of said it in the most distilled way I could, which was for me creating that type of film.
I mean, beautiful. Each scene spoke like volumes, and I think that was your story, but I felt like even when I was watching each scene, somehow related to me. It felt like it was like you were telling my story, and I feel like that's probably what a lot of people, how they connected with that, reliving those moments, because when you're just talking straight to camera, you're just telling people, hey, I'm gay, but you were actually around scenes, in these scenes, you were living, kind of reliving parts of your life.
Yeah, and I think, and this brings us full circle where we were talking about the Charmeleon, Charizard evolutions in the different stages. And mm-hmm. this is, I think, true to all artists,
yeah.
is that at first in my career, I was moving so hard into specificity and my own perspective that I lost sight of who even I was speaking to as an audience. Mm-hmm. It was very much just going so hard into just only my story without thinking of the universal sort of appeal or reaction. And then when I was first in digital, I lost some of the specificity and was only thinking about appeal. And what it comes down to is the mixture of both in the most beautiful way is the most powerful type of art, where that video I was speaking to with the specificity of my experience, but by being specific, it had universal relatability.
Mm.
So, and that only comes from being very honest about what I'm putting on screen. So that opening shot was the first thing I envisioned when I made the video, which is a portrait of a family with a traditional father, mother, mm-hmm. sister, brother, and myself sitting in the middle, dressed in a sort of non-gendered androgynous outfit, standing out in color.
Yeah.
And that shot is my experience growing up thinking of myself as a black sheep. But also, I think, probably in many ways resonant to a lot of queer people's journeys, a lot of people of color, just seeing that family portrait. You know, I was doing that with the specificity of an Asian American family, but at the same time,
it translates.
I think that translates
yeah.
to other people's experience.
For sure.
And that's kind of the place I've settled in my Charizard form, which is you speak with specificity, and hopefully that specificity resonates with people outside
yeah.
of that group.
And then also and that was beautifully said. Thank you. Also
the Charizard part.
That was the best part that I'm going to tattoo on myself.
And I feel like since then, also just like you coming out and being yourself, like your outfits are just incredible.
Oh,
I feel like
my
I
goodness.
Never know what to expect, and I'm always
there's no boundaries now. There's
yeah.
nothing
yeah.
So let's talk about your style, I guess, evolution. Like because you even at events that I see you at.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
I certainly I'm a cisgendered gay man. And the fluidity and the wide, beautiful diversity of the queer community is really interesting for me, because what I have come to find is I love gender expression, and I love
yeah.
playing through that with fashion. For me, I feel very comfortable with, the art I dabble in visually. I like seeing it expressed through clothes and makeup on myself.
Yeah.
So certainly one day I'll have the tools with which to maybe be able to like maybe design my own stuff or like
yes.
do all my own makeup. But at this time I get to work with like a lot of amazing stylists and makeup artists who can help realize visions I have.
Yeah.
Because certainly I think when I first really realized I could do that and also make a statement was at the Unforgettable Gala, which is the annual like Asian American Awards in media. And, you know, in any like cultural place, especially with Asian Americans, we often now are also pushing with our own wave of empowering media.
Yeah.
sometimes, especially on the traditionally masculine side, where Asian men have been emasculated in media, we're always pushing this like suited and like you got to be sexy,
right,
and you got to be like the hottest Asian guy to be considered like revolutionary for the community, because we've been so often like castrated through scripts and through depictions. And so I often feel like there is still like machismo in a lot of cultures. Like I'm sure you can relate, like this idea of being macho and being manly is prized. I'm sure when I first became like,
honey, we love Trey.
Yeah. And I think when I first became popular, even at BuzzFeed, people were like, oh, he seems like a masculine Asian guy. So I like
wow,
that.
Wow, really?
Yeah, because I was very like hard and edged and very rigid in my presentation. I won a lot
of
stuff.
I thought you were hot. Yeah,
thank
still
you.
Do.
I mean, when
you.
I met you, I feel like you weren't as like fabulous. Like your outfits were,
no,
it was
no,
pretty
I was,
like normal. Not
very,
to say normal, but like, yeah.
I was just like a
dude.
Yeah, like just a dude. And I certainly
sorry to say, but yeah.
But like I was
you know.
Yeah.
But you work with dudes who are awesome. I love those dudes.
I did like a few years ago at the Unforgettable Gala, I realized I wanted to just go as how I wanted to dress, and I worked with this amazing designer, and we did this like corseted, red, lacy, sheer, booted look with like gold flaking makeup, and I was just this crazy looking unicorn amongst a sea of suits and ties, and I felt very comfortable.
Yeah,
I felt good about it, and it was great because, you know, you saw a lot of people have this reaction when they saw me, and I just wanted them to know, as someone who was invited there, someone who is clearly known by the other people, that there's a spot at the table for queer people in all cultures.
Yeah, you create the space.
Exactly.
You are the space.
And we have an opportunity, particularly as queer people, to express so much without saying something, just through style and through your look, you know?
So with that being said, I want to know, is there anything that Hollywood could learn from the digital side when it comes to inclusion, diversity? Because it seems like digital really has picked up with, obviously, you can create your own space, you can be who you want to be, and that's kind of translating over to, you know, television, film, and this Hollywood industry when you're hearing these buzzwords. But is there anything else that they could learn from digital?
I think that the biggest thing is, it's interesting because with digital, I also come to find, and this is a whole different podcast, that the democracy of digital is also kind of starting to go a little traditional. Because now the digital space is its own monolith of an industry.
Right.
So, for instance, the Try Guys, we are very privileged in our position because we got in at the right time, we became famous at the right time.
Yeah.
And so we're guaranteed a certain amount of views because we're considered like top tier legacy YouTubers.
The 1%.
It's a 1% of YouTubers. And there used to be more of a Wild West feel where people would be popping up and you'd be like, oh, who's this person?
Yeah.
But now clearly with even the trending page, which doesn't actually mean anything, but when you see who's featured, it's certainly, it's interesting because I feel like digital, the heart of it is being able to see people you've never expected to see before, to be able to learn or hear from their voices from different parts of the world, from different backgrounds, and have like maybe a little less control over being able to choose that. It's like that exposure. And I think with Hollywood, the issue is mainly that so much is rested on these tried and true formulas in their minds that they think are working. What's interesting now is Hollywood is picking up on that spirit of digital, and the formula is now a little more about like who's the slightly alternative, unique voice, which I think
YouTube
is great.
YouTube is like censoring LGBTQ voices.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think it's great that Hollywood, especially with streaming, because now the streaming war is about to happen, everyone wants content,
right,
which I hope to be a part of in some way, but they are looking for those different voices. But certainly I think that so many people are always chasing money, and I think that's always a big issue. And I think that when you chase message, it becomes so much more of a the impact that you make in the end, I think, is what we're all in this to begin with for, which is yes, something successful monetarily is a great like big old check mark to get the next check to do the next thing, and we understand the game, that's part of the game of any business, but what lasts and outlasts everything else is the message and the impact. And I think that if you can like make one person think differently or feel differently or change their mind about something that they've never seen in a certain way before, versus having a billion people watch it and just like not feel a thing, then you've done so much more with that short film or that small podcast or that that little movie that could, because I think in the end, what legacy you take forward is not the quantity of the impact, but the quality.
Yeah.
And I think that people are always just so obsessed with quantity, which unfortunately, I think digital plays into that with likes and views. We have a culture now that actually essentially the democratization has also created this like capitalist idea of like the more likes you have, the more worth you have. So it is all very much a reflection of just how I think the politics of our world works. Mm-hmm. So it's just always this moment, I think, where industry-wide, whether it be digital or traditional, and see, now you know I'm a grown person because we are at a different stage of media, and digital is at the same level of Hollywood. I would have used to say like, oh yeah, digital, everyone can learn from digital because, you know, you can see, you know, people of color and queer people, but
now it's,
you know,
one and one.
Now everyone's trying to lift up those voices, and now you're seeing the sort of glitches in the armor that is digital of how things are being sort of like, how quality and worth is being sort of measured. And I think that in the end, I just always stress this message about the quality and the reflection of your own work, because the people who need to hear it the most, I think, which is the kids, that's the best thing I've gotten from being a digital person, is I've gotten to speak directly with kids, particularly queer kids and kids of color, who've told me how work has affected them. Because I'm sure if I just became a traditional Hollywood director, I never would have had that opportunity.
Never.
But in the end, that their reflection, how they go through their lives, if they can learn from that, then that's the best type of impact I can have. And that's coming from someone who generally hates kids. Do you know what I mean? So, in the end,
those are your kids, but you just don't need to feed them necessarily. Yeah, feed them knowledge.
Yeah. It's my final form, my Charizard.
All right. So as we wrap things up, just you just came off tour. Mm-hmm. You got your HRC award.
Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you.
You have a book out, The Hidden Power of Effin' Up.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? What are your dreams? Like, where will Eugene Li Yang be in a year, 5 years from now?
So on the Try Guys side, we have an amazing production company, continued the digital presence. Yeah, so
but away from BuzzFeed.
Yeah, so we quit 2 years ago. Yep. And so everyone who ever sees him on the street, it's not Eugene from BuzzFeed, it's just Eugene.
Yes.
Of course.
I got to just make sure they know that. But we have our own company, and we'll be, you know, we're pushing very aggressively into unscripted content for traditional spaces.
Yeah.
And then on the personal side, I'm finally in the right mind space, particularly after the coming out video, to finally pursue all the TV shows and features that I've dreamed of doing since I was in high school, since I was at USC Film School.
Yeah.
As someone who's fully realized as a queer person of color who can tell his story in the most measured way possible, from that edgy, like weird, angry film kid to the totally universally appealing, like digital poster boy.
Yeah.
And now I just want to make the best stories possible without compromising and without being at that table with people and withholding information. Now I just am going to host the dinner party. You can come to my TV show. Mm. You can come to my film.
Yes.
And you'll know that I'll be speaking truths.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, oh my, thank you. Eugene Li Yang, it's been great to have you here.
I'm mesmerized by him.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
When you think of narcissism, I feel like you think of bad things, like people that are bad are narcissistic.
It
has a negative connotation.
I think of it, it can be negative, but I also think of it as a positive thing where someone can be just very confident in who they are, and maybe they do like to kind of either talk about themselves a lot or they like to be in the center of attention, but they earn that. They actually work towards kind of being in that. It was like they had kind of a personal growth thing. So I don't know.
Oh,
narcissism to me, I feel like,
I feel like it
can be layered. Because I think people just throw out the term narcissism or narcissist, and it can be, you know, like you said, a dig. But I don't obviously sometimes believe that's the case.
Well, yeah. There's a study in an article actually in Mike.com that talks about the upside to narcissism. So it's something we wanted to dig into because it is possible to be a narcissist, and it's a good thing. So here to help us navigate this is Laura Lee Townsend, Southern California-based therapist who specializes in trauma recovery. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes.
Just as we get into this, can you explain the difference between narcissism and confidence? Is there a difference?
Yes, absolutely. So narcissism certainly, well, it's a label. I like what you were bringing up before that, you know, it gets thrown out all over the place. And, you know, I'm really hesitant to just label things like that. Narcissism can be, it's that extreme. It's that overconfidence, the point where you start not having empathy for others and you just way are over inflating your sense of self-importance. So confidence, on the other hand, you know, it's the, yeah, I've worked really hard. I've earned the right to rock whatever I'm rocking, and that's awesome, and I'm proud of who I am and what I do.
Yeah, I don't look at it as a positive. If someone called me a narcissist, I'd be like, ooh, that's not what I want personally.
Well,
it feels like sociopathic,
though. I think that's the way that it depends on how people are using it. Now, if people are using it as kind of like and saying it as a character flaw, I think, of course, then they mean some harm towards that. But I do want to bring up something, especially in a study in the UK at the Queen's University Belfast. They actually, an author said that there was two poles of narcissism as grandiose and vulnerable. And I saw in the article on Mike.com that you actually don't believe in those two kind of versions of narcissism. I wanted to know if you could go a little bit deeper on that.
Yeah. It's more of that idea of, I mean, the personality disorders are just, you got to be really careful. Or I come from the perspective of you need to want to take that with a grain of salt because it's putting a lot of blame on, like, there's something wrong with you as an individual for having some of these characteristics. Mm-hmm. And so it's just being very, I'm just want to be careful with using that as a label. Mm-hmm. Versus kind of going back to now having traits, that can be a great thing. There can be that, again, if you have that sense of have that sense of I'm great, then that's, you've earned that.
Yeah, so at what point does it get, like, not to throw around labels. But
overboard.
Like, but, like, sociopathic. Because I feel like...
I don't even know what sociopathic means, and I feel like a lot of people use it. And I don't think people use it
right.
In the correct way. That's why I want to say overboard more so than, like, sociopathic.
Right. There's too many factors that go into what creates a personality for someone. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to do studies on that, and you just want to take that with a grain of salt. Now, yeah, and then true... I want to, it goes back to the individual, you know, what do you think it's a problem? Is your confidence, if you don't think it's a problem, then it's not a problem. But if it's creating problems within your relationships and other people are saying that's a problem, then that's, you know, might be something to look at. But
yep.
Typically we don't see narcissists coming in for therapy.
Because they don't think they need it.
That's so amazing. So how do you know? I mean, then if you're like in water, you're like a fish in water, you don't see that you're in water. What do you do about that?
Right. Then you're kind of using that barometer of your relationships. So if you are running into people over and over who are just saying, wow, I can't handle being with you. Like, this is too intense. You've really got to take this down a notch. So, but then are you going to be receptive and open to hearing that feedback?
Well, I would love to actually talk about that when we come back from our break. Like, if you are, like, if you do have a friend that you're noticing, like, some of these traits, you're like, dude, how do you have those conversations in a positive and kind of educational way, and that where it doesn't seem like, oh, you're just kind of throwing out terms? I would love to kind of dive into that. Coming right up next. Don't go anywhere.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
Is there an upside to narcissism? Joining us again is Laura Lee Townsend, Southern California-based therapist who specializes in trauma recovery. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks.
So on the other side of this, and I posed this question before we left to go into a break, I want to know if you do have a friend that you kind of recognize, like, dude, they are, it's a little bit unbearable to kind of be around them. How do you have those conversations? Because obviously, like, some people still want to be friends, but, like, how do you have those conversations where you're actually, you know, getting them to understand where you're coming from?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. Phrasing it, you know, in a sense of, I'm wondering, have you noticed that, you know, whatever those undesired things are. So, for example, I'm wondering if you've noticed that you tend to, you know, turn people off, or that people tend to shy away if you go on and on about yourself, or, you know, have you noticed that, or has that crossed your mind? And then based on their response, you know whether to, you know, continue on, because either they'll say, oh, no, what do you mean? And there's your invitation to explore that a little further. And you can also add in that, you know, I think it's great that you clearly have a great self-esteem, but, you know, it can get overboard. So you've got that invitation to explore a little further if they're open to it. But if you bring that up and then you're met with, I don't know what you're talking about, you're ridiculous, and you just shut down, that also gives you information of, well, okay, then you can choose to try to push the issue or not.
So, all right, besides talking a lot about yourself, how do you know you're dating? And I, by the way, I speak for a living, and sometimes I do talk a bunch about myself. It happens. But
even when she's not on air.
Yeah, that's why I live and breathe this, okay? What you see is what you get in front of the camera, on air and off air. But besides
look at her now. Look at her. This is a prime
now
example.
Now I'm just getting anxious prime and I'm example. Rambling because I feel like, you know, defensive. No. How do you know that you're dating or friends with a narcissist?
So, again, it's all on a spectrum. I mean, if you see someone, say they're exhibiting so extreme, I would say, then narcissistic tendencies, you're going to notice that they just have that overinflated sense of I'm the best and other people are unworthy of my time, or why, you know, it's very hard to be around them because they're just really overly involved with themselves and they may lack empathy into, so what's going on with you? Tell me about your day. Tell me, I want to know what's going on in your world. You know, they really lack that just awareness of what's going on with other people. And especially, or like for a boss then too, like there's just overworking, over demanding, no concept of, oh yeah, people might want to have lives. So, and then dating, it's just me, me, me. It's a very one-sided relationship. And you kind of feel yourself like, am I even here? Because this has been all about you.
So what are the positives? So if you find that you have a narcissist in your life, or you might be a narcissist, what's the silver lining?
So the silver lining, I mean, back to the studies point, I mean, there's to a degree when you have that a little bit higher than average self-esteem, say, yeah, that's going to be awesome to keep you protected against. If you feel like you're great, you're probably not going to be very anxious about what other people are thinking about you because you're already just going in with the assumption that I'm amazing. Everybody's totally going to agree with me. So, yeah, you have like so much less stress, so much less worry. Definitely. And then, two, just that whole mental toughness capacity, because it's that self-fulfilling prophecy. You're walking into every situation just, yeah, I'm great. Who cares what other people think? They're dumb.
So, awesome. Yeah. So, all right. So
I'm into that.
Yeah. Oh, into what?
I'm into the idea of walking into a room and being like, I don't care. I'm just going to be myself. And I don't really care what other people have to think of me. And I think, you know, that is.
But you can be a humble warrior.
Yeah,
I like that.
I mean, yeah, you can. But I do think there's something to be said about, you know, demanding and knowing your worth in spaces that may not see that. And I think that is very important to go in and walk into any room and being like, I am worth this. And I understand. I need people to also understand why I'm worth this. And I think that's brilliant. You know, that's how the greats are, you know, happen. I think every big celebrity, like the Beyoncés or the Michael Jacksons and all these things, they all have a little bit of narcissism in them. Like they know their worth. That's why they rise to the occasion the way they do.
And if you
Right.
Yeah, and Laura, just as we wrap this up, if you are experiencing the negative sides of narcissism, what can you do? Like, what advice do you have for people that to find themselves and I guess be more have more compassion and empathy? How do you teach that? Is it possible?
Oof. Absolutely. Yeah, it's possible. So, I mean, first step is of course starting with awareness. So, again, if hopefully someone is close enough to you, you've cultivated a relationship where someone can say, hey, this is hard for me to say, but have you noticed that you're overly self-involved, or you really push people away, or whatever that is? And then having that capacity to go, oh, I need to look at this. Let me really sit on that. So awareness comes first, and then just simply having the desire to want to work on that and be like, whoa, is that really true? Is that on them or is that on me? And then working with a professional to let me explore that and being open to exploring it.
All right. Well, Laura Lee Townsend, thank you so much for being here today to talk about narcissism with us. Where can people find out more of your work?
Oh, yes. Thank you so much for having me. You can always learn more about me at my practice is OC Integrative Therapy. So you can find me there. So that's integrativetherapyoc.com.
Okay. Well, have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Now, coming up, we've got what's trending in the news. Top of the hour, we've got a surprise from Sam Smith. That's up next.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
Yeah, we are back. What's trending in the news? What you're listening to is a cover of Donna Summer's I Feel Love from none other than Sam Smith. I love it. I love this song, by the way. And longtime collaborator Guy Lawrence of Disclosure. I know a lot of people have mixed reviews on this one. Yeah. I'm liking it. I know you don't like it.
I don't like it at all.
I just love this song.
I wanted you to turn it off.
God, I was getting into it. It's Friday. I was feeling it. Fine. Moving on to our next story since I didn't tease it at the top of the show.
Do you know what inspired him to do that randomly? Like that Donna Summers thing. I love Donna Summers, but you know, there's something to be said about people doing covers. When covers are not meant for you, don't do them.
What makes you feel like it wasn't meant for him?
Because I just feel like some covers shouldn't be touched, especially by legends.
I feel love. Like, he feels the love.
Shira, but that's okay. But I think some songs just should not be touched. Like there's just, you know, they're already perfect the way they are, and I feel like that song, you know, Donna Summers should be the only one singing that song.
Maybe you're just not feeling the love, right? Just got to open up your heart.
Sure, that was the first time you've ever heard that song. I bet you can't even,
Are you out of your mind? All right, moving on. Lori Loughlin. All right, so she is continuing to say that she's innocent. She asked a judge today to accept a not guilty plea to a new charge she faces in that college admissions case. Now, Loughlin and her husband also requested to waive their need to appear in court to be arraigned on the new charge later this month. They basically are just like, no, this all didn't happen. Come on. The more we deny it, maybe it'll go away. They could each get a maximum 20-year prison sentence if convicted, if it ever happens, or they might just keep delaying it. So that's an update on Lori Loughlin. And that's it. That's what's trending in the news.
Actually, there was something interesting about that. I saw an article that was saying that could her children be charged as well?
Are they
and
liable?
One of the lawyers was saying that they shouldn't be thinking that they're in the clear because there is a possibility, especially if they didn't know about everything and a lot of, you know, if they knew there was some inner workings happening, there's a possibility that they could even get charged because this is something I wanted to talk about during
just
the tea.
FYI, the Donna Summer, going back to I Feel Love, I was a bar mitzvah dancer and I worked at DJs in the 90s and we played that song.
What's next?
We got Yaz Queen after this. Don't go anywhere.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
We are moving into our Yaz Queen of the day. You sounded evil.
Because it's funny.
Yaz Queen.
We have a Yaz Queen. No, we had a brilliant conversation offline.
This Yaz Queen goes to 8-year-old Jackson Champagne, who went viral last night, Halloween night, as this video that was captured on a
I like that their last name is Champagne.
Yeah, Champagne. Was Champagne.
No, it's Champagne. That's offensive.
anyway, this Nest camera captured this young boy with this candy bowl. Okay, this is what happened. So he went up to this porch. The candy bowl was empty on the small table. And he basically, instead of just like either leaving it empty, he took his own candy and threw it in the bowl. And the whole thing was captured on camera. He said to his aunt, "There ain't no more candy." And he said,
so he took his candy out of his bowl. It must have been like Tootsie Rolls and something nasty. He didn't want it anyway.
No.
It couldn't have been like the good stuff because no little kid is giving away the good stuff.
Why do you think that there's nice kids out there like, that don't care about getting
all
the
First of all,
candy.
The good stuff, like the Twixes, the Reese's, the M&M's.
I don't think he picked and chose which
I don't know. I would get rid of all the Tootsie Rolls if it was me.
His aunt goes, "That was really nice." And then he cheerfully said, "There we go." Just like that viral moment was born. The husband who saw the clip on his Nest camera, he sent it to his wife saying, "You won't believe this." And the wife was blown away. The guy who found it, he said he renewed the faith. He had a renewed faith that there are still good people out there.
I see through this kid.
You're horrible.
It was Tootsie Rolls. I need to know what type of candy it was.
No. And his father said he's always giving. He's sweet, kind, soft-spoken kid. I've never seen a moment where he acts out negatively toward humanity.
So sweet.
And then he also said the young kid said why he gave the put the candy in the bowl. He replied, "For the kids after me." Now that's going to be a guy that's going to like start. I don't know. I always think of these people as like they're going to start a nonprofit or be giving. Like you see,
okay, don't put too much pressure on the guy that gave away Tootsie Rolls. He gave away Tootsie Rolls.
I'm just creating the whole story for his life after this. This will be the essay that he uses to get into college. So now,
maybe they were like. I don't know, like yellow starburst. I would give those away too.
Why don't you go and watch the video and then look and like zoom in and create a whole Medium post? But do we really know what candy he gave?
I will, yes. I think that's a very important fact. But okay, let's get into our personal Yes Queens for the week because we always do this every Friday. Yeah. We always give a special Yes Queen out of the week that has just something that has inspired us or something that we just want to. Shout out. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Mine goes to Greta Thunberg and the youth climate strike here in downtown Los Angeles and all the young people who came out today. I was there in downtown LA. It was so inspiring. They had their megaphones. They were, you know,
protesting.
They were protesting. Everyone had signs. And there are people of all ages, but specifically the young people who didn't go to school today instead went there and came together. It was just really incredible to see.
That's
and to
beautiful.
Be part of.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Because we talk about it, we report it a lot, and it was the first time I got a chance to actually be there on the ground. And it made me want to do more. And it really encouraged me. Or it was encouraging to see the future generation. And
yeah.
We wonder what happened with our generation. Well, at least they're picking up where we kind of left off or things go.
Well, my Yes Queen shout out goes to, and I don't know if this is weird, but my Yes Queen, it was the highlight of my week, talking to Ross Matthews.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
I've always been a fan of his. He's someone that has really inspired me where I like in my career and where I want to go. And so a special Yes Queen goes out to Greta and all the cool kids out in the climate change. And it's Ross Matthews and little Jackson Champagne giving back Tootsie Rolls.
I love you said cool kids because they're looking to cool down the earth. Get it? So they're cool kids.
All right, so we'll be right back for extra fun story coming up next.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
Now, before the break, we talked about a good kid. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
We were talking about good kids who are out there giving candy back. Well,
Tootsie Rolls back. Let's be clear.
There are also some parents out there stealing candy.
Isn't that normal? First of all, kids on sugar, wow, that's like the apocalypse happening. There's no way that they are going to be able to eat all that candy themselves.
I know.
So well, I think this is normal.
Well, it's not just an assumption anymore. There was actually a survey done that revealed that most parents steal from their kids' Halloween candy. I love the survey. I want to imagine the people who like created this, like, okay, guys, Halloween's coming up. Let's like pull a bunch of people. Actually, they pulled 3,000 adults aged 18 and over, found that 85% of Americans plan on celebrating Halloween this year.
Doesn't Jimmy Kimmel do that?
Yeah.
That video where
so
he, like, his parents pretend like they've eaten all their kids' children.
Yes, and you see all the kids' reactions.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so horrible, but it's so funny.
Yeah.
According to the survey, 71% of Americans stock up on sweets by buying more candy than they need for the night. It also found that 78% of parents admit to stealing candy from their kids' Halloween candy, with 28% eating more candy than their own kids. What do you think is the most popular Halloween candy, by the way?
For some reason, the way this is phrased, it keeps making me think that we're talking about eating children. I'm like, why? Why does my mind keep thinking about that?
I don't know.
That's weird. Sorry, guys.
You're watching too many weird movies.
No, I don't, actually. I don't really understand. I've never had an impulse to eat a kid, so that's weird.
Okay. Well, what do you think is the most popular Halloween candy?
Reese's. Reese's.
Did you know because you read this?
No, Reese's are my favorite.
It is. It's the most popular Halloween candy.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Duh.
62% of people naming it their favorite candy. But yeah, and this was from the cashback website, topcashback.com, which I don't know the association.
I don't see how people wouldn't want a Reese's. Actually, speaking of our sister station, K-Rock, Stryker and Klein, they did something on their Insta story where Stryker tried candies for the first time, and he actually hated. He had never tried a Reese's ever. And he actually hated it.
What is
I was
wrong
so
with him?
Upset. I
knew
like,
he had bad taste.
No
now
taste.
This
You're right. No taste.
Confirms it. I hope he's listening right now. No, they're on the air.
Yeah, they're going to pop in real quick.
I'm going to just send it. Be like, at this time in the podcast, we talk about you. You should check it out. Anyway, so I mean, I'm not surprised that parents eat their kids' candy. I also feel like after hours, if you're like late night, you know, the kids are asleep, you're stuck, you know, cleaning the house.
It's like eating the cookies that you leave out for Santa. I hope, because Santa's very real, and Santa gets
what do
full.
You think? There's people that believe in Santa listening?
There might be. Are you kidding me? You're ruining. We don't know if our listeners are listening with their kids, and they haven't told them that yet.
I don't
you
know.
You got to think about the bigger
picture.
We talk about
pretty like, big things, including my sex life.
I think children need, yeah, children need to be informed about specifically. But yeah, like, you know, it's just like that with, you know, Santa eating the cookies.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think I would share. I would teach my kids sharing through sharing things with me.
I really feel like I missed out on experiences like this.
Exactly.
Like never
so
having
got
like
to
trick or treating, or like the only candy that I got was from like school, and I ate that before I even got home. So my mom never had a chance.
Listen, I feel bad for you because I do feel like you missed out on a big
don't
thing
feel
that
bad.
That's
it's
part of
the devil's
childhood.
Holidays, my mom would put it.
I know, but it's not anymore, and you know that. You know better than that.
It's not anymore.
So
it
we
was
need
before.
To we need to give you the proper Halloween. Next year, we are bringing you trick-or-treating, Ryan. It's
I'm not
happening.
I'm too grown for trick-or-treating.
No, you're not.
I'm way too
just
grown.
Just wear like...
I'll do some adult trick-or-treating. If y'all want to give me some little naughty stuff in a bag, I'll do that.
All right. Well, we need to make it up. Maybe we'll like make the office do trick-or-treating for you.
Aww.
So you experience
wow,
it.
Wow, that sounds like a viral video that Ellen would invite us on for.
Well, maybe I'll do it and then we'll go viral. Like office gives at, you know, colleague his first trick-or-treating experience.
I'll cue the waterworks and be like in tears. I've never done this before, and I feel like I really missed out.
Yeah, come on. And now they're gonna go back then to this whole show and be like, they produced the entire thing. It was fake. They did it to go viral. They're scam artists. Okay, well that does it for our Halloween story.
Way to end that one.
Did you see, by the way, just speaking of Halloween.
What?
Did you see Heidi Klum's Halloween outfit?
Yeah, she
the
was
results.
She was an alien and her husband was an astronaut.
It's amazing. I'm always impressed.
Did you have something to say about
no,
it?
No, I just wanted to know your thoughts because you're like the you're like the fashion police.
You could end this at any time. You know that, right?
What? I could have what?
Okay, so we'll be back to close out the rest of the show, honey. Don't y'all go anywhere.
Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, the new Channel Q.
Well, that does it for today's show. It's been a fun one. If you missed any of our interview with Eugene Liang, you can go back to our website to listen to the entire conversation. He was great. We are channelq.com. And a shout out to our entire Channel Q fam in Palm Springs right now for Palm Springs Pride.
Yeah, I'm dealing with some triggering situations where, you know, it's called FOMO. And I'm missing out on everything out there. And I'm really sad. But I'm happy that they are looking
very
fabulous
happy for everyone
and
out
wonderful.
There.
And DJ Lisa Pittman is looking like the zaddy that she is. And honestly, I love them. So have a good time, guys.
Yeah, we'll just be celebrating from afar.
We love our Palm Springs
it's okay.
fam.
We do. And we'll be back. We will be back with a vengeance, won't we, Ryan?
Yeah, so I love you guys.
We'll be back on Monday. And, you know, we're here every single day. We'll be getting into the Trump administration, kicking off National Adoption Month by attacking LGBTQ plus families.
Mm-hmm.
And a scientific reason why going back to real life after vacation can be so painful. That's on Monday's show. Let's go there with Shira and Ryan, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern. Again, we post all these shows throughout the week as a podcast. So if you miss any of this amazingness, don't you worry. It's available on WeAreChannelQ.com and wherever podcasts are available. We are sending you love and light.
Honey, remember to slay, y'all.
Have a great weekend. And now, enjoy some music from DJ Lisa Pittman and DJ Alex D right here on Channel Q.
Happy Pride, Palm Springs.